In religious studies, discussions about architecture tend to center on sacred spaces and their aesthetics or their formative role in the life of religious communities. Fair enough. But can we speak about the theology of built spaces, like homes, or the ethics of the architectural process for both daily residences and the homes of religious communities? As it turns out, a book being published this month takes up these topics, and its author, Elise Edwards, joins us to talk architecture, theology, and ethics. Stick around to hear more. Are listening to Currents in Religion, a podcast brought to you by the Department of Religion at Baylor University and by Baylor University Press. I'm Zen Hess. Thanks for listening to this episode. My guest today is Dr. Elise Edwards, an assistant professor in Baylor's Religion Department. As you'll hear, she practiced as an architect for some time before pursuing graduate degrees in theology and ethics and arriving at Baylor in 2013. She has a new book out this month with Lexington Books, called Architecture, Theology, and Ethics, Making Architectural Design More Just. That is what we're talking about today. Enjoy the conversation. Dr. Elise Edwards, thank you so much for joining us on Currents in Religion.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So you've got a wonderful story. Tell us about the story that led you to explore the intersection of theology, ethics, and architecture.
Okay, well, I could start all the way back in childhood when I was a Girl Scout.
From the very beginning.
Yeah. When I was a child, I really wanted to do something artistic with my life.
Yeah.
So I wanted to be an actress or a singer or a dancer. And I don't think I had the skill for any of those to do those professionally. But I had this love of the arts and anything art related. And I started developing an interest in design. It used to be just watching TV shows that would show model homes and looking at, you know, the plans of building communities in the newspaper. And eventually I decided I was going to be an architect. So it was the artistic side, but it was also very much a people profession. And
yeah.
I thought that's what would be great for me to do. So that's what I went to college and studied. I went to Florida A&M University, which is a historically Black college.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of what we were learning in architecture school had a sense of social responsibility associated with it. And many architecture programs talk about that. So architecture is not just about buildings, but about buildings for communities and buildings for institutions and for people. And it's very much about the experience of architecture that so many of us who learn how to design architecture are valuing.
Yeah,
I studied at FAMU and got my Bachelor of Architecture degree and then my Master of Architecture degree.
Okay.
And in the master's program, we focus more on theory than in a different degree program than Bachelor of Architecture program. And so I started studying gender and design, so how gender relates to architecture. I did a master's thesis on that and a design project and graduated and was really inspired by that project and thought I would go back to school someday for something else related to architecture. I wanted to teach at the university level.
Yeah.
And I ended up going to seminary, just totally different thing for my own Christian development.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started seminary, I was like, oh, this is the method. This is the approach I want to use to ask these questions about architecture that I had been thinking of since I had been in architecture school, which is, why are we designing in a particular way? What makes sense for architecture of our time?
Yeah.
And I said, oh, what if I ask those questions theologically? Like, what does our understanding of God help us understand about how we should design architecture? So I did my seminary degree, and I was nearing the end of that and was working on a master's thesis that dealt with the concept of place in contextual theologies. And my academic mentors were like, yeah, this is great what you're doing. And I was like, yeah, I still haven't done this project where I bring architecture and theology together in this kind of way. They said, oh, well, that's a dissertation, what you're talking about. And we think you should do that.
Oh.
And it was very encouraging. And so that's what I did. I had a career change at that point. I'd been working in an architecture firm while I was studying part-time on my master's in theology. I went to a PhD program that valued interdisciplinary work and worked on a dissertation that talked about architecture and ethics, which is what I was, my specialization in my PhD program was on. And questions about moral agency helped me refine it. So there it was with the ethics approach instead of just theology, but theological ethics, I was able to ask these questions about how Christians live. Like, what are the things that guide our everyday decisions?
Yeah.
And then parallel that with design. How does design reflect our everyday decisions?
Yeah.
So that's,
I don't expect
work that,
that most religion departments would be equipped to do a dissertation that includes architecture.
Yeah.
So what did your committee, who was on your committee?
Yeah, it was great. I was really fortunate. I had a committee of people who were really excited about what I was doing.
Okay.
Rich Amesbury was my chair, who he was really helping me think through questions about Christianity in public life. And I had Ellen Marshall, who's a Christian ethicist, as one of my early mentors. She moved to Emory while I was still at Claremont Graduate University. So when she left, I started working with Grace Gao, who's another Christian ethicist, who's still a good friend and mentor, and Ellen is also.
Yeah.
And then I worked with Monica Coleman, who was really approaching theology with her her perspective in process thought, but in womanist thought as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had this committee that was really open to different ways of thinking about what religious commitments mean, how they're grounded, and how we live them out in public life.
Yeah.
So they were like, I'm not an architectural expert. And then I had an outside committee member. So Curtis Sartor, who was at Judson
and did the architect stuff.
Illinois, he did architecture stuff. So
that's
he was
so
an
cool.
outside reader.
That's so fun. And okay, take us back. When you were practicing as an architect, what's the coolest thing that you helped build?
Yeah, so this is an easy one. It was a project in my hometown.
Okay.
So that's exciting,
right? Yeah, yeah.
To do something in your hometown. It was a project for Montgomery College.
Okay.
And this is probably one of the first major projects I worked on. I'd worked on several projects at the time, but this is one that I worked on from the very beginning to completion.
Mm-hmm.
So this was for a community college, Montgomery College, which had a campus in Tacoma Park, Maryland, which is where I lived at one point too. And Tacoma Park and Silver Spring are right next to each other. So they were expanding the Tacoma Park campus to bridge a metro tracks, train tracks into Silver Spring. And so our architecture firm did the master planning, so determining how to connect these new buildings for a new campus and a pedestrian bridge crossing the train tracks, how to connect the old campus to the new campus, and did some initial like conceptual studies for what these buildings would look like. And then I got to work on the first project of that new campus expansion, which is the health sciences building. So seeing that project from the conceptual stage of like, what could this campus expand into to actually seeing the building under construction and then completed. And, you know, I would have family members, you know, texting me or calling me saying, I just drove by your building.
Yeah.
It's like, yes, it's my building.
That's so fun.
It was great. So it was a health sciences building. Cool. But there were so many exciting projects I worked on. I did a lot of college and university work.
Okay.
And the great thing about college campuses is they have so many different kinds of buildings.
Yeah.
So while I really enjoyed working on educational buildings, there were also chapels and museums and galleries and cafeterias and all
sorts
of stuff.
That's really cool. That's really cool. You alluded earlier to the fact that in some of your architecture classes, there's questions about how to do architecture well, considering that these are spaces for communities or spaces for belonging. In your book, you talk about the difference between architecture or architectural design and urban planning. It might just be helpful for me and for our listeners to get a better grasp on what the difference is between those two things.
Sure. Yeah, you know, I use the term architectural design pretty loosely.
Okay.
I have a book that's coming out that has architectural design in the title. And it's the appropriate term, but it's also a little narrow.
Okay.
But it helps us understand architectural design as different from something like fashion design or graphic
sure.
design. What I'm interested in is the built environment.
Okay.
So when we're talking about the built environment, this, again, is a term most people aren't familiar with, so I don't use it that often.
Sure.
Or I use architecture instead. But the built environment is everything we build that we live in. So that includes, you know, our buildings, but also the infrastructure and our roads, our landscapes that we alter. It's all built. It's not the natural, untouched world. It's the built environment. And there are many different disciplines that work on aspects of the built environment. So architecture is our buildings.
Okay.
And some people will separate that out into like real architecture versus just like structures.
Okay.
So, you know, architecture being this thing that has a certain amount of intentionality in the design.
Okay.
They wouldn't want to call a shed architecture, right?
Yeah.
But I don't really have much of a use for those kinds of distinctions.
Sure.
If it's a building and someone thought about how it was going to be designed, then for me, that's architecture.
Okay.
And I also know people who went to architecture school, who ended up working on house plans, you know, that get sold, you know, as already designed things, right? And people who put a lot of attention into what their sheds in their backyard look like.
Yeah.
So, you know, if an architect or someone who is trained in architecture school works on it, I'm willing to call it architecture. So architecture is the buildings or sometimes other structures around buildings like sheds or pergolas or gazebos, things like that that have been designed intentionally.
Yeah.
And architecture, the work that architects do covers everything inside the building and usually up into about a foot outside of the building. So that transition between inside and outside, where you have the roof overhangs and your services from your building connecting to like the city pipes and stuff like that.
Okay.
And then you have people who work on architecture who are not architects. You have interior architects or interior designers. You have engineers very often working on various components that go into the architecture. So it's a team-based profession.
Right.
Right. There are lots of different kinds of people who work on architecture.
Right. So urban planners would basically, they would consult architects or draw architects in, but urban planning or, urban planners would be kind of designing as a whole.
Yeah.
As
urban
a whole
planning, in Eric Jacobson's book on the Christian engagement with the built environment, he talks about urban planners as designing the space between. So actually, that's the title of his book, The Space Between. So urban planners are doing the spaces between the buildings.
Yeah.
And again, you have landscape architects
and
engineers and a whole team of people working on that. So urban architecture, urbanism, urban planning tends to look at the spaces between, but also the configurations of buildings.
Right.
So questions about zoning. And that has to do with what are the different types of uses that should go in a particular area.
Right.
Those are done by urban planners, figuring out where new developments should go, what the density of that development should be. And then by the time architects are doing that, what we call master planning, where they might be looking at a whole campus or a business park or a healthcare complex, right? That's multiple buildings. Mm-hmm. they're doing that within the restraints of the zoning that has already been set by urban planners.
Got it. Yeah, because you mentioned at one point in your book that that architects have to be, if not practically, but also aesthetically, in tune with the surrounding kind
Absolutely.
Of world
yes.
that their built structure is going to go into.
Yeah.
And so it's not totally disconnected, but there's some parameters set by urban planners.
Absolutely.
And then architects build within that and take their cues. And
yes.
Okay.
And which is why we should be concerned, I say we, everyone should be concerned, not just about what's happening at the building level, but at the zoning level.
Right.
So those zoning decisions really impact the air quality that we
right.
have when
right.
we're talking about where industrial facilities are going.
Mm-hmm.
They have to do with the density of our neighborhoods and whether or not we're able to have buildings next to us in mixed-use developments, whether, you know, residences can have shopping
right.
Businesses, retail right next to them,
yeah.
or whether they have to be in a different part of the city.
Right.
So I think of urban planning as like the fabric, the overall mm-hmm. fabric of the city, connecting the different parts of a city together, looking at the neighborhood level, mm-hmm. looking at the block level. Whereas for architecture, the largest unit we might have is within that block level,
right?
And then right. we're going, you know, room by room,
yeah.
and details even smaller than that.
You are listening to Currents in Religion. I'm speaking with Elise Edwards, assistant professor at Baylor University, about her forthcoming book, Architecture, Theology, and Ethics, Making Architectural Design More Just. Before we get back to that conversation, here's a little chat with the folks at Baylor University Press about a book I think you might like. I'm here with Cade Jarrell, one of the editors at Baylor University Press. Cade, what do you have for us today?
Hey, Zin. Good to be here. So today, I would like to promote an edited volume, Baptist and the Kingdom of God. We're delighted to collaborate with our Baylor colleagues, Lane Scales and Joel Chavez. So these two scholars are at the forefront of progressive Baptist conversations about the role of the church in the world. And with this volume, they have gathered an amazing coterie of scholars from newly minted PhDs to established scholars. And so what they're doing here is offering a diverse array of perspectives on how the Baptist movement has engaged with and continues to engage with and transforms sociocultural dynamics across the world. If the kingdom is anything, it is people putting in the hard work of shaping the world into a more just place. And this volume is kind of an exploration and also a celebration of that, of how Baptists have contributed to that. So that's what this collaboration is all about.
So tell us a little bit about, you're working at the intersection of architecture, theology, and ethics. In what sense is architecture or architectural design ethical?
I think architectural design is ethical because it has to do with how we live.
Mm-hmm.
So again, when I was in graduate school and I was looking for PhD programs, I tended to look for programs that had some sort of theology with a practical focus.
Yeah.
I totally value other kinds of theology,
yeah,
but
yeah.
for this study of architecture, it's really about what do we do with what we believe?
Yeah.
Architecture is about creating the spaces that we inhabit and the spaces where most of us do our living.
Mm-hmm.
So, we go on walks and runs and exercise outside and do those kinds of things. Many of us have gardens. I don't personally, but many people do and enjoy it. But most of our living, our working, our sleeping, our time with our families is spent indoors in places that have been designed for that. So when we think about design and we think about what architecture is designed for, it's already responding to questions about how we live.
Yeah.
I'm trying to draw back the curtain on that a little mm-hmm. bit to say, how are the ideas about how we live shaping what we're designing for? And are there questions about justice that factor into how we live that should also change the way we design?
Yeah.
So basically, architecture is about what happens inside and the relationships that happen inside. Yeah. And those are ethical questions for me.
You give an example in your book that I thought it took me back to when I was a pastor about how some architects in certain places are considering safety. And so they're getting rid of external features or they're doing them differently, maybe. For example, like a bench or even a covered porch where someone who's experiencing homelessness or whatever might find those things as a gift, right? As a place of respite. Or it took me back to my own time as a pastor because we were one of the few churches who had in the front entrance a big porch area that was covered.
Yes.
And we often had people on the porch and I'm grateful for my congregation. Most of the people were concerned about how we could help.
Right.
But there were a couple of times where that led to hard conversations with congregants about what our space was for.
Yeah.
So I guess just thinking about.
Absolutely. I mean, I talk about this in ethics and in other topics too, but there's usually a sense of competing values, mm-hmm. right? Where in the case you're describing and that I talk about in the book, that we have this this high value we place on safety. So absolutely, we want our congregants to feel safe. We want our space to be hospitable to people who are new. And sometimes if they see unhoused people mm-hmm. hanging around, they feel unsafe or scared. Mm-hmm. I want us to extend that understanding of hospitality to not just the new visitors coming to the church or to the congregants, but to the people who are seeking that shelter.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So what are our obligations to them? And if we have these competing values of safety over hospitality or sometimes it's questions about privacy versus surveillance, how do we order those in a way that we're meeting the needs of those who are most vulnerable? Mm-hmm. And what I argue in my book, and this comes from a liberationist perspective, is that Christians should always care about the most vulnerable.
Yeah.
So the illustration you're pointing out, we're all concerned about safety, right? So how do we provide for those who are most vulnerable in that they do not have the basic shelter to cover them? Is there another place we might offer them shelter,
right?
And still allow that sense of safety?
Yeah. So you elaborate five commitments to justice-oriented architectural design. They're creativity, empathy, beauty, discernment, and sustainability. I'd love it if you could zoom in on any one of those and just walk us through how you imagine it being incorporated into architectural design.
Sure. So I think I'll start with creativity. I think that's the one I'll choose. All of these are there's chapters in the book devoted to them. I could talk about them for days. And sustainability, I'll mention, is probably the easiest one to understand. That's understanding how you design with questions about the health of the environment in mind. So there are lots of programs out there that mm-hmm. can help people design in that kind of way. But creativity is about the vision that we have for a project.
Mm-hmm.
So let me back up a little bit and say that when I'm talking about architectural design and about architecture, I'm really invested in the process that creates the architecture. I don't intend to tell people what their building should look like
mm-hmm.
or what architectural style is best. I tend to be pretty modernist, but I love arts and crafts as well, right? I have my preferred architectural styles. I don't sneer at Victorian architecture either. I love it.
Yeah.
But I think those decisions are always best made at the local level with actual projects in mind. So I don't have any design guidelines I'm giving people of like, this is how you need to design. I think the way to design oriented towards justice is to have a process that is just, that is asking questions about what the building is supposed to do. So I think that begins with creativity.
Okay.
I think of creativity as casting a vision mm-hmm. for architecture, meaning that when you're approaching creativity in terms of justice, it's not just about what inspiration is striking. Mm-hmm. You know, what should the building look like? What do we think other buildings of this kind look like? What are the standards for this building type? And I don't think architects are limited to those questions at all, right? We could find architectural inspiration in anything. I once had an architecture professor who said he got the idea for a building from a cookie that he was eating, right?
So that's my kind of architect. Yeah.
So architects get our ideas from all sorts of places. I'm not trying to hamper that. But I think creativity in design means that we ask different kinds of questions about what we're trying to do. Mm. And I think one of the first questions we need to ask is, does this building need to be built?
Yeah.
Right? Architects love to build. That's what we're trained to do. We want to build buildings or redesign buildings or redevelop buildings. We want construction to take place. Yeah. But I think the first question we have to ask if we're interested in justice is, does it even make sense to build something here?
Mm-hmm.
And then to ask, is the purpose that we have in mind a good purpose?
Yeah.
There's a group, and I'm blanking on the name of the organization, I think it's Architects and Designers for Social Responsibility.
Okay.
They have a pact that they do not a pact, they have an agreement that they do not design prisons, right? Okay. It's a sense of they're taking a moral stance against a particular type of building.
Right.
That they recognize societies build, but they're saying, I'm not going to have a part in that because of the way that the prisons function in our society.
Right.
And so that to me is a moral question that starts at creativity.
Right.
It's like, what are we building and should we be building this?
Right.
Or is there a different type of facility that we should be building? So creativity to me begins in architecture, when it comes to questions of justice, is about what are we building? Why are we building it for? Who's part of this process? Mm-hmm. And what's our big vision for the project? That includes all of those things.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was really interesting to hear you just say a little bit about the process and who's included in it.
Yes.
I just think that's such an interesting question because when I do think about construction or anything, I mean, I don't know anything about building a building, right? If I were ever going to construct something, I would just call someone like you and be like, can we do this?
Right.
And I would just expect you would tell me exactly how we were going to do that.
Right.
But it sounds like you have a broader vision for who can be involved, at what level, and that actually really matters.
Yeah. And there's a lot of expertise that
of course
architects have, that there's so much training we go through and exams and everything to
the
make
exams
sure that
a cakewalk.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah,
oh, yeah. Sure.
No
so,
problem.
So easy. Right. And all of this is designed to make sure that we as architects are designing in a way that meets the health, safety and welfare needs of the public. Right. So, I mean, there was this movie years ago, The Towering Inferno, right, where there's this building, this skyscraper that's on fire and it's unsafe. Right.
Yeah.
It was designed with so many cost cutting measures that the building isn't safe and people can't escape. So architects are licensed to make sure that we don't do that. Right.
Yeah.
That buildings are safe. But what we're not really tested on is our exams. None of this covers like the moral implications mm-hmm. in this sense. And architects think about this and are concerned about this. But the question, you know, should you be building a prison is not one that comes up in your licensing exam.
Right.
It's when you're designing a prison, what are the needs?
Do? Right. Yeah, yeah.
So I want us to ask those bigger scale questions and include lots of people in it. So when we're thinking about a classroom building, for instance, mm-hmm. You know, here on a university campus, we're thinking about classroom buildings. We have to ask who's consulted in our discussions about what those buildings should be.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly we have department chairs that might participate in those discussions, but are we talking to students who are in those spaces regularly?
Mm-hmm.
Are we talking to the people who are teaching there and are teaching the most in those spaces? I love department chairs, but they're not usually the ones teaching the heaviest mm-hmm. loads in their departments.
Right.
You know, the facilities people have excellent intentions and guidelines and expertise, but are the standards that have been developed for the university or the college and what an office should look like, mm-hmm. are those tailored to the needs of specific types of researchers?
Right.
And the materials they need, the work they're doing?
Right.
Do they know what the processes look like?
Yeah.
I used to have an office where we had office suites with an outer office and then the inner offices. Mm-hmm. And it's terribly inefficient when it comes to office space, right?
Yeah.
There's this redundancy. But it was great for being able to have semi-private conversations with students.
Right.
Right. So you could have the door open, which many of us like to do so that mm-hmm. people can hear us. But it's not everybody walking down the hall
sure.
who's overhearing your conversations.
Yeah.
And so it allows that level of privacy and yet exposure.
Yeah.
We had undergraduate students who would work with us who would often work in those offices
yeah.
and could have conversations with us while they're doing
mm-hmm.
their work. We don't have that kind of office design in,
right.
in our renovation, and it means that we can't work in that way
right.
anymore. Even something like giving student a makeup test, we have to book a room for that, find a space for
right.
that. There's a different type of process that mm-hmm. takes place, different things that are allowed
right.
within the space just by the constraints of that.
Yeah.
And someone can look at an office and say, okay, they need file cabinets, they need bookshelves. Unless you're talking to the people who are actually doing the work, you mm-hmm. may find out, oh, actually, I don't need a file cabinet. The drawer I have in my desk is enough. I don't
right.
need a whole cabinet space, but I could use an extra bookshelf there.
Yeah.
Those kinds of decisions are only understood when you talk to the people who
yeah.
are using the space.
Right.
So I argue that users should be a part of the design process.
Yeah.
They're not obligated to be, but they should be invited into that process
yeah.
in some kind of way. And earlier, the better. I mean, we can say, oh, well, you're talking about furniture when we're designing a project.
Right.
Certainly that comes at the end. But if you're talking about what kind of furniture is needed in an office, that changes what size that office needs to be.
Right.
And those decisions at the very beginning of a project make a big difference.
Save a lot of headaches. Yeah.
yeah.
Well, that's really interesting. And it just raises the complicated nature of these sorts of questions in an institution like Baylor, you know, from how bigger institutions can make these decisions more communal. I
yes.
mean, it seems like that should just be a no-brainer part of the process, but I can imagine just certain factors that could make that more and more difficult along the way, but really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, the question when we're talking about building users,
mm-hmm.
I want us to start expanding that, right?
Yeah.
Who are the people that we are thinking about as using these buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So again, the classroom building, that's the easiest example for me
yeah.
to give because that's where
right.
I work every day. You know, we're thinking of professors as using it, students. Okay, that's obvious. Those
mm-hmm.
those two groups of people. But again, I don't know many students who have been invited into a design process.
Sure.
But are we thinking about the people who are cleaning the building, who
right.
are maintaining the building?
Right.
They know more about the operation of a building than
yeah.
I do,
yeah.
right? In terms of like what certain layouts allow
mm-hmm.
and do not. What about people who are visiting the building as guests for the first time, who are
right.
coming in as a guest lecturer
mm-hmm.
or people who are touring the building? There are some buildings that are very much designed for those people. We have
yeah.
on Baylor's campus a new welcome center. That one's really more for people who are visiting the building
right.
Who are visiting the campus for the first time than current students,
yeah.
right? So there we know there's a different kind of user
mm-hmm.
there. Or to a sports stadium, we know there's a different kind of user there.
Right.
But I want us to begin to think broadly and expansively
mm-hmm.
about that at the beginning of the design process. And I say that's an ethical issue because very often who we're not considering is about, or it reflects a hierarchy
yeah.
we have in place
right.
about who really matters
yeah.
in that space.
Yeah.
Who is the space for, really? and who's just sort of on the periphery mm-hmm. of using that space.
Yeah.
When I would say anybody who's within that space is using it to a certain degree.
Yeah. You have spelled this out in a variety of ways already, but I'm just going to put the question, this kind of simple question, simple as in it's been simplified so that you have a chance to say directly what you think. What for you is good architecture?
Yes. So for me, this comes from a sense of God's purposes for architecture, which is about, at a very basic level, providing shelter. So this goes back to the example of the church building and the people who are just looking for shelter from the elements outside. So good architecture provides shelter. So from a very functional standpoint, it stands up to the elements and gives us space to do the things we need to do within it. It has a good, meaning moral, purpose. So a building, you know, church buildings, I love church buildings. They're designed for a good purpose most of the time.
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
Which is for us to worship God and to honor God, but also to form relationships and to meet the needs of our communities, right? We host dinners and community service projects and all sorts of things in church buildings.
Yeah.
AA groups meet and other recovery groups meet in churches very often, right? Are the buildings serving a good purpose? So does it shelter us? Does it serve a good purpose? Those are pretty basic. But does it delight us aesthetically, right? I mean, I haven't said much about beauty, but I think this is really important that our buildings evoke a sense of delight in us, that we enjoy being within them, that they stir our senses, that they connect to our souls at some level. And to say that doesn't mean that every space we go in moves us deeply.
Sure.
But that they are enriching our lives, that we're more than just people with basic needs, that we're people with a hunger for things that are interesting and meaningful, and that our architecture reflects that.
Yeah.
So does it shelter us? Does it have a good moral purpose? Does it delight us in some way? Those would be characteristics of good architecture. And most architects, I think, are going to agree with that. Where I'm going to go further again is, does it have a good process that results in the design?
Yeah.
Was it a fair, equitable, just process where people are being listened to and where the building itself is designed to structure relationships that are not always hierarchical?
Yeah.
That there are common spaces for everyone to enjoy, that the building serves the common good, not just an individual good. And so that process. And so the last point related to that is, does the process continue after the building has been designed? There's a great book by Stuart Brand called How Buildings Learn. And the argument in that book is that buildings have a whole lifespan.
Yeah.
And that design doesn't end when the architect's work ends, but that buildings adapt and learn and change based off of how their users are using them. So when we're in Moody Library, when the building was first constructed, it didn't have sound booths for recording in it, right?
Yeah.
The building learned. The space that we're in, the floor that we're in, was redesigned. It has been redesigned a couple of times over the past decade to include the facilities that we now need to support the things that are done at a university, right?
Yeah.
And so the building learned. It continued to grow and change and made the kind of adaptations that needed to take place. And it's not the building itself that learned.
Sure.
It's the people who occupied the building, the designers, the librarians, the students, everyone who was using this facility, who said, there's a need for this.
Yeah.
And then the institution was able to respond to that.
Yeah.
So adaptability, does the architecture open itself for change in the future? And I think that's where questions about sustainability really come in too. Meaning, can we allow this building to grow with us, or will we just have to demolish it
right
before its time and create more waste?
Right.
But can the building grow and adapt with us over time?
Fascinating. Dr. Edwards, you have given us some really intriguing and important things to think about. Thank you for that. Thank you for what you're doing. And thanks for joining us on Currents in Religion.
Thank you. This was wonderful.
Once again, thank you for listening today. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with someone who might enjoy it too. Oh, and make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss future episodes. Also, if you could, leave us a review to let us know how we're doing. Your review will help others find this podcast too. We'll have another episode next week. I'll be speaking with Robin Jensen from the University of Notre Dame and Mike Parsons from here at Baylor about their new co-edited volume on early Christians and their arts. A bit of a shameless self-promotion here. I've got an essay in the volume, so I'm extra excited for you to hear more about the book as a whole. Until then, take care.